things happen to people who listen to radio.
Once we understand the bug, we will defeat it.
Are you ready for
radio? The only good bug is a dead bug.
Shoot a nuke down a bug hole, you got a lot of dead bugs. All right?
Some say that a live and let live policy is preferable to war with the bugs.
I say kill them all.
Yeah.
Put it on and leave it on.
Welcome to Bug Radio. It's a corker this week. We're going to be talking to Britain's finest TV critic, Ellen E. Jones, about whether the bug has ruined telly. What the fuck are we even allowed to do now? We'll find out. And is this the beginning of the end for your precious car? To toast the bug waffle, as always, I'm joined by the big cheese of Burgess Park, Mr. Kieran Monks-Kaufman. Talk to me.
Well, I have a small confession in that at the weekend, I saw a friend for a distance jar on the river, and I was feeling compromised about that, that I'd let the side down and possibly destroyed the NHS. But then turned out that was retrospectively legitimized by these new rules, as Dua Lipa would say. You know, now we can see people.
So we can't see our parents.
No, it's a sort of dogging protocol. So you can see one new person each day in the park with proper distancing, but it can be a different person. And presumably you could have a series of non-overlapping engagements through the course of the day. So this is very vulnerable to abuse, presumably. And the police have said that it's not really going to be enforceable. So we won't see them cruising their meat wagons around the park, yelling through megaphones at people to piss off home anymore.
No, I mean, it sounds basically like a second spike to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose this is the good old British common sense, as the PM suggests, being invoked. But I don't know if we've got a lot of that. I mean, I can imagine people will be taking advantage. And I mean, you don't really need loopholes. This is a Swiss cheese in a sieve.
Radio. So you cannot meet two parents at the same time.
Well, you could if they're 2 meters apart.
Okay. Right, so you could go to the park and you could meet up with both of your parents at the same time, as long as you all kept on. Okay.
We talked on earlier episodes about how, you know, probably most of the British public probably are going to be able to get through this and are going to be able to find ways of behaving that won't cause too many problems. But you only need, say, 10% of people to just be morons. And our number goes to Disneyland.
I mean, I'm particularly thinking about perhaps people seeking religious exemptions. So will witches seek to arrange themselves in pentagram formations, perhaps around a blood sacrifice?
Can you stand in a pentagram while observing social distancing?
I suppose it's just an example of the kind of exemptions that people might cut for themselves. I mean, a friend of the show writes in, "This is bullshit designed to risk the safety of workers. I will no longer feel bad getting the lads round for a barbecue." Because he's a key worker, and so he feels that he's being fucked with, in that part of these new protocols is that this sort of back to work drive where, you know, we've had the unedifying spectacle of middle class professionals who can comfortably work from home saying, "Come on, you serfs, you know, get back on the tubes, get back on the buses, go and clean some offices." You know, how is anybody supposed to retain any distance or safety under those circumstances?
It seems like there are some members of the Tory cabinet who are broadly supportive of the lockdown and they want people to stay in their houses and not die, basically. And then there's another faction which just wants to get the economy going. This set of messaging, it feels like a function of just a completely incoherent and divided cabinet more than anything else.
But, I mean, do we have any common sense? I mean, is that the sort of reasoning that can fly? Because
some of us do, some of us don't. That's the point, isn't it?
Another theory I heard is that, you know, maybe a percentage of people are going to be able to use their own reasoning effectively and sort of not really follow any rules, but still not really create that much danger.
Just don't be a dick, basically.
Yeah. I mean, do you see any potential to the, like, the common sense system? I mean, one thing is, I think the government deserves a lot of stick at this point, but yeah. I think some of the thinking about how to use a behavioral approach is when they didn't introduce the lockdown straight away, I think that was based on quite sound reasoning that there's a limit to how much people could handle. And we're now sort of seeing the extent of that limit. And now we're probably at a point where even if you imposed a very strict lockdown, I don't know if people would go for it.
Well, if they wanted to get the genie back into the bottle, the only way I could see that happening is basically you would start to have to involve the army. I mean, in large centres like London, Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, you might need them to be armed as well, just because the fact is we don't have very many policemen, thanks to the Tories. We also don't have as many soldiers as we used to, because that's been cut as well. So one way of making a little go a long way, if you see what I mean, is to give them guns. You would effectively have martial law.
That's not the preference of Bulk Radio.
No, but if I tasked you with trying to get this lot back into their houses, you know, for the foreseeable future, how would you do it?
I suppose you would want symbolic deterrence, and, yeah, and that could be, I suppose...
Guns will do that.
You could have, like, actors in stocks, you know, being pelted with rotten fruit, and, like, signs painted by the stocks with things like bastard, you know, this guy didn't obey the lockdown, you know, sort of visible deterrence. And I mean, there is a bit of that, because whilst applying the new common sense diktat, the new rules allow for much greater fines. So in theory now, you can get fines of up to $9,000 if you're a repeat offender.
$9,000? I never heard $9,000. I heard it going from 30 to 80 or something.
Yeah, that's for a first offence. Okay. And then if you're a repeat offender, it goes all the way up to about $9,000. And I think at that point, if you're getting caught that many times, you've got no creep at all.
Yeah.
And probably you shouldn't be thinking for yourself. Or you're just unbearably rich, in which case you should be fined more. But people are going to get around it. I mean, because this is a sticking point with domestic workers, cleaners, nannies, people like that. People are like, well, I'm just going to employ my family to clean my house. You know, checkmate, police state.
Yeah, I did see that. That's quite an interesting loophole.
Yeah, I mean, if they really want to keep people safe, this is sort of an abdication of responsibility.
Did you see there's this thing in Belgium about bubbles? It says from Sunday, every household in Belgium can invite up to 4 guests to their home. 2 sets of 4 people make a corona bubble who can visit each other's homes. No one else is allowed into the domestic circle. How the fuck do you police that? You're relying exclusively on civic mindedness.
Yeah, and I suspect this is going to be quite a common idea. So rather than releasing people back into the wild, they say you and maybe 1 or 2 other households can see each other, but no one else. But I suppose there's a bit of carrot there. I mean, because if you're telling people that they can see, you know, a family member or a friend that they've really been missing, then that might be sufficient incentive to limit themselves to that. I suppose it's very Darwinian in the sense that everyone's going to sort of reveal who their favourite people are. It's going to be a little bit like in a playground picking teams for football, and some people aren't going to get picked.
Yeah, or some people might have massive waiting lists, and other people might just have nobody. I mean, that's really the most tragic aspect of it, because you would imagine the people who are loneliest and most alienated in, you know, normal life are probably going to get the shitty end of this as well.
Excuse me. I couldn't help noticing that strange and interesting plant. What is it?
Another perverse thing that's come out of this is the deification of the garden centre. Frankie Boyle raised the interesting point that people are now going to be doing everything in garden centres. They're going to be, you know, mingling and socialising and having affairs amongst the hydrangeas and hyacinths. And suddenly just garden centres are going to become like the new sort of pubs or discos. But can you have a, you know, a lively night out in a garden centre?
Well, it depends how late they stay open, doesn't it?
If they're entrepreneurial, I guess they'll, you know, want to push it.
So do you think you'll start to get mergers of garden centres with like squat party sound systems and stuff?
I imagine so, yeah. I mean, they're just going to incorporate Faces nightclub from Ponder's End into the shrubbery, and it's just going to be like, fill your boots. And then I suppose another interesting part of the new rules is Sunak has been, we presume, bullied by the unions into maintaining the furlough scheme. But what we really need is a massive rent holiday, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if you can't pay your rent during the lockdown, how do people think the economy is going to bounce back quick enough for people to be able to be earning the extra money straight afterwards? And also, if you're a landlord and you've got a tenant who is having trouble paying their rent, but you also know that there's another tenant around the corner who wouldn't have trouble paying their rent, surely you would do anything you can to kick the first one out. These people don't own houses as like a charity, you know, like it's a business. If they're losing money, they want to stop losing money as soon as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I read a very affecting account by a lawyer who works with evictions saying exactly that, that we're going to basically see a bloodbath when the 3 months or whatever the guarantee expires.
So the rent holiday hasn't been extended like the furlough scheme?
As I understand it, not yet. I mean, there's certainly pressure to continue it and pressure to go further. You know, what could have been given to mortgages or beyond? I mean, I know that groups like the New Economics Foundation are saying, given that nobody's going to have to pay anything back for ages on a macro scale, we need to not look at sucking all the demand out of the economy by immiserating all renters, which is a huge demographic. So the people that are pushing for, you know, an economy is like a household, let's, you know, tighten our belts, that's not going to fly.
Stephen Bush was being quite interesting about this. There's a whole load of people who are talking about how we're going to need a massive injection of austerity after this. But Stephen Bush thinks that the extent to which we're going to be paying for this is wildly overstating. We only finished off paying the £20 million we borrowed to reimburse slave owners in 1830, about 5 years ago. And there's no reason not to pay this debt off at a similarly slow, if not slower, pace.
Exactly. If you've still got the ability to borrow at historically low rates, you can just keep... I mean, the state is not going to be under any pressure to balance its books, given that every country is going to be in the same position and that rates for borrowing are going to remain that low. So it would only be a sort of sadistic sop to the right of the Tory party to try and impose these measures on renters, most of whom already don't have any savings and most of whom will have been impacted in their working life. So there's absolutely no case to not go further than a rent holiday. Basically, no one should pay rent. And then if enough people do that, then it will be impossible to enforce.
Now, more than ever, we need...
Radio. Commence blathering.
There's been a whole hoo-ha about how bad the messaging's been.
We think it's important to stay sane. Let's
go. Ladies and gentlemen, direct from
Southeast London.
Radio. Baby, let's go.
When the fuck is this going to end?
Just trying to find something properly weird. We need to find whatever it takes to get through this rotten fucking plague.
You ready? So, it's a great honour to welcome friend of the show, Ellen E. Jones, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So, is the bug going to change TV forever?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the government today announced that it was all back to business as usual, that film sets and TV sets could start filming again. But anyone who's ever been on a film set or a TV set knows that that's utterly unworkable. Almost everything that goes on involves people being right up in your face, like from putting a mic on to doing your makeup as a performer. So, it's not going to happen. There are kind of ways around it. And in fact, there's two programmes. One has already been on air on ITV, Isolation Stories, which was filmed according to social distance guidelines. It basically had people like Sheridan Smith in it and Eddie Marsden, and they either filmed themselves on their phones or their production company dropped off production equipment outside their houses. And then I guess they waited for the requisite 24 to 72 hours until all the virus was gone before they picked it up and made their stuff. And that's actually been quite well reviewed. I think that was pretty good. So it's possible to do stuff. There's another one on Netflix I've already got in for production called Social Distance by Jenji Cohen, who's the woman who did Orange is the New Black. So that should be interesting as well. These are sort of anthology stories about people's experience of coronavirus. And that's kind of one of the main ways at the moment that TV has got to get around this problem, is that they're actually telling stories about what it's like to live in corona times or during lockdown. So featuring people wearing masks, socially distancing. Although there's a limit to that because you can't, if you're being totally authentic, when you're inside people's homes, we don't tend to wear masks. And if we're within members of that same household, we can get close to each other, but you can't replicate that on screen without breaking social distancing. So the other way is that they'll quarantine the cast and crew. And that's obviously massively expensive. There will be productions and shows and film studios that have deep enough pockets and are banking enough on the resultant box office of the product to make it worth their while, but that'll be difficult. But I think I'm positive, I'm optimistic, because filmmaking is problem solving, and it's always been about making great art under the circumstances and with the constrictions and doing what you can with the budget. And that often, you know, creates great innovation. So I mean, we should expect there to be some really great art made. It's more the kind of commercial end of TV production that it's going to be problematic for.
And is there going to be a need to cut back on people like makeup artists and people working with costumes? Are they going to be out of a job as productions try and pare back to the bare bones?
Yeah, it really depends on what angle they go for. I hope not, because one of the things that has been obvious from early experiments with, you know, actors filming themselves, is just how useful these professions that don't get the glory that actors often do are. Like, you do need a professional makeup artist to make people look the way they're supposed to look on camera, and you do need, you know, a best boy and a gaffer and all that to make sure the electrics are working and the sound's right and all these other things. But, like, when there hasn't been professionals working on a production, you can, even the most unschooled in the ways of TV production audience member can tell instantly. So you need the professionals.
I think they tell subconsciously.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
can't immediately pinpoint what the problem is, but they
yeah.
just
no, we all speak the language of television, we just don't all know the grammar, you know?
Yeah.
We're facing this looming cliff edge when we run out of soaps, are we not? How might those venerable series attempt to keep going?
This is genuinely filling me with dread, this one. Because talk about, you know, how football, the Premier League, is integral to the morale of the nation. Soap operas are utterly integral to the morale of the nation. And Coronation Street has not been off air for 60 years. That's, just think about that for a moment. It would be huge if they run out of episodes, and they very likely will. Production shut down on most of the soap operas almost as soon as lockdown was announced. And they have a backlog of episodes because they tend to film about 4 to 6 weeks in advance, depending on the soap opera and other things. And in order to make that backlog last as long as possible, they've already been cutting down the number of episodes they screen per week. So they've gone from like 4 or 5 to 2 in most cases. But even so...
Rationing.
Yes, rationing, which has been hard for soap fans already. But even so, they're coming up to that cliff edge that you mentioned. And I think EastEnders is going to be off air by June, and Coronation Street the same, or possibly EastEnders slightly earlier at the end of May. So... you know, there's been some talk of ways around it. I saw one big EastEnders head on the internet suggesting that the actors record their voices but just have animation for the visuals. I can't really see the BBC going for
that.
That
would take ages to do, though.
Yeah, well, this is someone who's underestimating what actually goes into animation. In fact, I was so... because I'm an EastEnders fan, so I was intrigued by this, and I happened to have an interview with Pete Docter, who's the CEO of Pixar, like the next day after I saw that. So I kind of raised this issue with him, like, are we going to see a boom in animation? And he was like, no, you don't understand how animation is made. It's very collaborative, actually. Like, you could technically, I suppose, sit in a room and just do your bit and then send the file over to someone, you know, but the really good stuff, which Pixar makes, it happens by ideas sparking off each other and people with technical know-how getting together with people with artistic know-how and so on and so forth. So, like, if you want it to be good, it's going to need people sitting in the same room. And those ideas just don't happen over a Zoom meeting in the same way that they do when people are face-to-face.
People are often dismissive about soaps and perhaps TV in general. So if you could tell us a bit about how you feel it supports people through this time.
Yeah, well, there's the escapism thing that we talked about. Like, it's fascinating... one thing that is common to almost every household is that TV is massively important, especially in times of stress and trauma. Like, we all, most of us go to TV in some form, or storytelling at least in some form, for comfort. But some people like their comfort to be totally escapist. Like, they want to hear nothing about coronavirus at all, and they want it just be like in some lovely rom-com or, you know, some fantasy world. And some people, like myself, I watch a lot of true crime, and I've noticed that I've been watching even more as the anxiety of lockdown has kind of set in, because I think my theory is that it's like one misery can replace another, in the same way that, like, if you've burnt your hand, you run it under a really cold tap. Like, it's still painful, but it's painful in a different way. So it sort of distracts you. So there's that. And one of the interesting case studies to look at is what happened after the Spanish flu. Obviously, TV didn't exist in 1918, but it is notable that there's so little mention of the Spanish flu in, like, literature and art from the era. It's almost as if people were deliberately memory-holding it instantly and wanted to forget about it. Yeah, they just wanted to forget about it. Whereas, like... obviously, after the Second World War, there were loads of war films were like one of the most popular genres in the cinema in the late 40s. So there's two kind of different ways it could go in terms of what we want from entertainment after this.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Joe Exotic and this is Sarge.
He was like a mythical character living out in the middle of bumfuck Oklahoma who owned 1,200 tigers and lions and bears and shit.
Come here, love me.
It feels like there's been a couple of shows that have really dominated this plague period, you know, whether or not they necessarily deserve to have. So people in the early days were going crazy for the adventures of Joe Exotic and Tiger King and his assorted band of ne'er-do-wells. I mean, were you as smitten as a lot of people were?
No, and I think actually that in itself says a lot about what we're into TV-wise during this time. Like, the stuff that usually is event TV, there has something about it. Whereas it seems like at this moment when everyone's watching television, almost any old thing can grab our attention. Yeah. And Tiger King, I think, in a way, got lucky in that it dropped just when lockdown was starting and everyone was like completing Netflix and needed something else to watch and stat. Like, I don't think it's a bad show, and certainly the story is utterly fascinating. But if you're interested in that kind of thing, there was a podcast that did it better and in more depth earlier called Joe Exotic, 1V podcast. And I think probably a lot of people were saying kind of after the initial rush of, wow, aren't these people utterly bonkers, was over, that that story could have been told in 2 episodes as opposed to 10.
You know, when we were together in first year of college,
that was kind of a perfect time in my life, to be honest.
The other big hit, I suppose, has been Normal People, and everyone's been writing these very thoughtful essays about it and talking about how it, you know, it makes them feel young inside and it triggers all these feelings. Do you feel this praise is always also somewhat overblown?
Oh, you're really like leading me down a dangerous avenue here. Listen, I've got to watch out what I say about extremely popular TV shows aimed at middle-class female arts journalists, because...
You might talk yourself out I got into
a lot of trouble talking about Fleabag, saying some slightly... I mean, not even really slagging it off, but just saying some slightly uncomplimentary things about it when that was the one that everyone was talking about. But listen,
I remember
Normal
this.
People...
I agreed with you.
You agreed with me. Well, you could have said so at the time. I was out there on my own. So Normal People, very popular book, very popular show. Personally, I do think it's something a bit weird about people who are fascinated with the sex lives of teenagers, but anyway. But no, it's a great show. It's really well acted, like all that. It's just that there's so much to watch that happens to suit me more, and you know, I find it difficult to get that enthralled by it. But no shade on anyone who is obsessed with it.
It gets credited with having quite sophisticated class and gender politics.
I think that's probably true, and I haven't watched enough of it to know. But like, I've seen people that I respect. So I think Sally Rooney is a bit of a socialist, basically, right? And it's definitely, there's like a class difference. But it's, you know, this kind of, it's Romeo and Juliet territory, really. Basically, she's a bit posher than him, and they manage to overcome their class differences through sex.
It's like when Kate Winslet goes down to the third floor.
Is Normal People just a Titanic remake without the ship? Discuss.
Yeah, and I suppose a less charming male character, because, you know, whereas Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic was all sort of twinkling eyes and sketches, this other guy's just sort of like morose and sort of just hulking about. And
I disagree with you there, but it's entirely subjective whether you fancy the leads or not. And I do think something that people don't talk about enough with regards to television is that it really helps your enjoyment of the show if you happen to fancy one or more of the actors is in it. So I think that's probably what's going on with some people and Normal People. But the thing about Normal People, though, is like it's making people nostalgic for their lost youth. And I think that says a lot about the way time kind of flows or doesn't flow in lockdown, and that, you know, we're all sort of a bit depressed by the relentless passage of time and how we're all stuck indoors. I think Normal People makes us nostalgic for our kind of lost youths and lost summers. And that's obviously very moving and connects to a lot of people.
Do you think that also because people who are in relationships are now spending so much more time with their partner than they would have done pre-lockdown, that it's making them more philosophical about their own relationships and they're maybe sort of comparing themselves to the people on screen?
Yeah,
maybe.
Absolutely think there's something in that. Like Normal People is, what it's so good at is depicting the minutiae of intimate relationships and all that kind of unspoken stuff that passes between people. And most of the time, that kind of thing goes over most people's heads. But now we're all focused on that and zeroed in on that because that's all there is, you know, in most of our lives. If you're sharing space with someone, all of those kind of little tiny interactions become incredibly important. So I think Normal People definitely connects on that level and chimes with people and resonates because of that.
And given that those two programs we've discussed have been perhaps the most hyped, you know, what haven't people been noticing much? You know, what sort of shows have really been delivering for this difficult time in history?
That's such an interesting question, because the thing about TV is that it always kind of sits quietly, you know, unheralded and unnoticed in the corner, despite being absolutely central to our lives. And often that's the way with the shows that are the most important as well. We kind of take them for granted. And I think without question, the show that defines and captures the experience of lockdown and reflects the way we're feeling about coronavirus, as it has done in many other circumstances already, is Gogglebox. I don't know who pitched it to Channel 4, first of all, but they must have had balls of steel, because it sounds like the kind of idea that just should never have worked. And not only does it work, it happens to be totally possible to film while respecting social distancing guidelines, just happily. So it's been able to go on throughout this process and be a constant in a way that our other constants like soap operas haven't been able to be. And that's, so that's really important.
Are the Gogglebox households almost like the soap stars of the lockdown era?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they're more because than
they're
that.
They're kind of families, aren't
they? They've become
they're
our families, sort of, yeah. And more that they're, so when we can't see our family, our Gogglebox family is there for us. But more than that, I think they've almost kind of stepped into a leadership role. Like when we're missing a kind of sense of national unity and direction from the government, Gogglebox has always got a bit of common sense for you. Like they'll watch, you know, Boris Johnson's latest speech and just immediately get to the heart of why he's talking so much frap. In a way that, like, a lot of people feel that journalism doesn't, or sort of news journalism doesn't, I should say.
Jamie's concerned they're not representative enough, that they're too left-wing.
Typical Jamie, eh?
Sorry, no, that is a disgusting libel.
And now to a cause close to our heart. What has the plague done for the sort of prominence and popularity of the Humble podcast? I mean, are our podcasts sort of assuming a more central role in the cultural landscape?
Well, I'm hesitant to answer this one, but I think podcasts, in a lot of ways, can do what TV does, and in a socially distanced way, which is important. They can create a kind of intimacy with listeners. Just there's something about being, like, you know, in the earbud, in the ear, and going directly into someone's mental space that makes them feel very intimate. You have your favourites very quickly and you can listen to them very regularly. So I think they're going to certainly be encroaching a little bit on what TV's done before. And the other part of that is that there's lots of TV stars twiddling their thumbs at the moment who are now starting to make podcasts. People like Louis Theroux just started his own podcast. And, you know, all you need...
Theroux taking a shot at the Bug Radio, trying to, you know, you come with a thing you best not miss.
I don't think he will miss, to be fair to him, but yeah.
Is there going to be a truckload of investment going into this one form of media that isn't really threatened by the plague?
Rather optimistic, I think. I mean, only because it's so obvious that you don't need that much budget to make a podcast. You know, you don't need that much equipment.
We want to get a new bell for ringing at key points.
You're going to have to fiddle your expenses quite creatively, is what I'm saying. If you want it's that heavy investment. I mean, the way the podcast model works is sponsorship, really, isn't it? And unfortunately, as soon as a podcast gets big enough to entice sponsors, it immediately sells out because all of those sponsored messages are really cringy and annoying.
Whenever I'm listening to, like, Stephen Bush trying to flog me shaving equipment.
It's always shaving equipment, isn't it? Why is it always shaving equipment? Women listen to podcasts too.
Yeah, shaving equipment or Squarespace or Beer 52.
Squarespace, yeah.
Basically. I always sort of think maybe they could have made the case to their employers that if you let me do this in a kind of funny, irreverent, not taking it particularly serious way, you could potentially shift more units. So that, but maybe they've done market research and they found out that actually that's bollocks. I don't know.
I just don't know if anyone has ever bought a product based on a sponsored. I mean, I don't want to explode the whole model of potential funding here, but
yeah,
like
careful.
I listen to a lot of podcasts and I can't think of a single incident where I've actually bought something advertised via a podcast sponsor. And some of them are quite funny.
But yeah, but then again, I mean, we are just generally quite cynical, slightly lefty kind of types who probably, we don't buy stuff as instinctively as some people. So you never know.
Yeah, well, if Mike Ashley wants to buy into this with Sports Direct, you know, we're flexible. Doesn't podcasts, and I include regrettably Bug Radio in this, have some work to do to sort of break out of its demographic chains. You know, there's certain types of people that listen to podcasts, perhaps, and some others don't. So how do we, if you've got any advice, get past that?
Yeah, this is the big problem and the big advantage that TV has over all other mediums. Really. You know, everyone watches TV, everyone and their gran and their auntie and their tennis partner. For sometimes that annoys me, like as someone who has written about TV and also been a film critic as well. Like with film criticism, people can get their heads around the idea that someone could be an expert, you know, because some people don't ever go to the cinema, but everybody watches TV and everyone has an opinion on it. And in some ways, that's a great thing because it means that TV has this incredible reach that no other art form can compete with. And podcasts, even though they can create that kind of intimacy that's similar to TV, they just don't have that reach because lots of people...
And there's too many of the fuckers, frankly.
Yeah, and they're very personalised. Like, if you find a podcast presenter irritating, present company accepted, obviously, it's really hard to listen to it however much you might be fascinated by the subject.
Yeah.
So they're very much an extension of the podcaster's personality in a way that TV is can be more collaborative, so it isn't necessarily.
I would like it if other podcasts would stand down and give us a bit more space. I'm a bit like one of those people who goes to a park and tweets about how angry I am that everyone else is in the park.
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, Ellen, thank you so much for your insights and for being courageous enough to appear on Bug Radio under what we assume is your real name.
Thank you. First time caller, long time listener.
Put it on and leave it on.
Already one of the big losers of the plague seems to be cars. All over the world, there are measures to try to encourage healthy perambulation, whether that's through bicycles or pedestrianisation. The government has introduced this new £2 billion scheme to a new era for cycling and walking.
Today, I'm announcing a £2 billion package to put cycling and walking at the heart of a transport policy.
This is what the document says. So we're talking, and some of this has already happened. I mean, I've seen it in Brixton. Pop-up bike lanes with protected space for cycling, wider pavements, safer junctions, cycle and bus-only corridors created within weeks as part of an emergency active travel fund, the first stage of a £2 billion investment. And intriguingly, also electric scooter trials. So you can hear the champagne corks popping in Shoreditch.
That's right. I mean, I was always a bit sceptical about this because the other kind of fly in the ointment here is that pretty much the whole public transport system is going to be massively restricted. If they're serious about getting the R below one, they can't carry on letting these tubes be rammed every morning. So given that there are now massive restrictions on people's ability to take the trains, the tubes and the buses, you would expect a massive load of people who have a car to use their car. And I think it's quite telling that levels of traffic have skyrocketed in the last 4 or 5 days, haven't they?
Yeah. And I mean, part of that is what we discussed in one of the earlier episodes, that people are just getting their speed on, you know, that flooring the Mondeo at 150 miles an hour.
Yeah, but that was because there weren't very many people around. Every prick and his dog is in the car now.
That's correct. I mean, it was pointed out that perhaps contrary to the understanding of the liberal metropolitan elite, 3/5 of people still take their car to work.
Is that nationwide, though?
Yeah, nationwide.
Yeah, so I mean, if you live in the country and you haven't got a car, you're fucked, aren't you?
You are. And it's still even a majority in London.
Where do they park? All of them?
Yeah, I mean, probably like underground lounges.
How many of them are there? That's like 30 quid a go to park your car in there for a day. We need to be buying car park space. That's where the money is.
Quite possibly, yeah. Although, I mean, I guess we'll see how it breaks down because, you know, there might now be more pressure on these people. And just quickly on the earlier point, when they show the tubes and the buses decanting large populations, this is a cousin of the photography that purports to show a very large number of people in a small space when it's actually sort of trickery to make it look that way, and it's not actually. There's actually a lot more space between people.
Hang on a minute. Wait. I've seen pictures from the inside of a tube. There's just whole rows of people sat next to each other on the tube. That's not 2 meters, is it?
According to my sources, use of public transport dropped to about 5% of its usual level.
It's still there, is it?
At the most disciplined point of the lockdown, you had about 5% of regular travellers.
Yeah.
And that's now increased by about 10% since these new rules. So, I mean, I guess that the people who want to shame all the cleaners and nannies are sort of waiting outside particular spots that they know quite a lot of people have to go to. So people are still trying to avoid these things, except the people that have basically been told that they have to. And I think the new guidance from the government has put the power back with the employers to insist that people go to work. In terms of whether this is going to be bad news for cars, I mean, I've already seen in Brixton, there's that big throughfare on the main road around the tube station towards the Ritzy, the now disgraced Ritzy. Half of that road is now being given over to cyclists and pedestrians. And in Latin America, there's been these very interesting reports because apparently, you know, I wouldn't purport to be Latin American or to know an awful lot about the kind of transport culture there, but apparently you got to be honest on Bug Radio.
True. You can't just say any old shit.
Yeah, this isn't court. So yeah, in Mexico and Colombia, apparently a lot of road space cars are prohibited, and so you can only use cycles and pedestrians. And so this has just triggered this massive surge in these clean forms of travel, and a lot of eco-oriented characters, which I suppose is most people with some cognitive function, are, you know, thrilled by this as a byproduct. So it's a cousin of, you know, isn't it brilliant that there are now ducks in Venice? And there's this one, a quite ingenious move in Florida. And often people in Florida don't get a lot of credit. They're seen as like, you know, they swung the 2000 election illegitimately. And
this is why they're talking about maybe Cuomo taking over from Biden. because they reckon Cuomo can win Florida. Basically, Trump can't win unless he wins Florida.
Yeah, Florida is a bellwether. Yeah. But in this case, the significance is that certain roads have been closed to cars, and this has allowed cafes and restaurants to have outdoor seating. So at a stroke, you kill two birds with a single weapon because you're creating more space for active travel, cycling and walking, and also you allow the economy to function a bit because restaurants and cafes can have properly distanced tables on the road. So, you know, let's give them some credit for that. We might be able to enjoy cafes and restaurants and bars, but on road.
So are these tables 2 meters apart?
Presumably, yeah. And so it's just quite an ingenious solution because it solves multiple problems at once.
It's a bit weird. It says certain streets in Tampa are being closed off to cars, but there's clearly a car in the second picture.
Oh, yeah? So you're like a Tampa truther.
No. I'm just
don't tamper with Tampa.
I'm just trying to figure out how the thing works. So they give over the roads, and the idea is that bikes can go through those tables.
Well, there's certainly space for it, and also certainly pedestrians. But perhaps what you're correctly raising is the cars won't stand for it. The belligerent motorist will simply pile through a fucking restaurant.
Yeah, well, it would have to be a very belligerent motorist. But, you know, as we saw in Charlottesville a couple of years ago, there are a few of those knocking about.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm going to say that this is a promising development. I mean, I've done some research and I wrote an article about the recovery of marine life. And I think all the experts say that that's not going to last. Yeah. That as soon as it's practicable, we'll be back on the waters, ascending the dugongs and the manta rays.
Packing.
Scuttling back to their hiding places.
Yeah.
But I think this is something that's got potential to endure, that we're going to see more and more of roads given over to cycling, to walking. And also to the hospitality industry so that they can safely accommodate customers and we can get pissed in public in a degree of security. Radio, the best station. Okay, so this being an unusual time, you get unusual developments. And one thing that struck me, and I raised the subject of robot dogs before in the context of benign robot dogs that do your shopping for you. But in Singapore, they've introduced this thing that looks like a fusion of a greyhound and a Walkman. And it's just sort of wandering around parks, just sort of like nagging people. And it's got sensors, so it knows how far people are apart from each other.
Let's keep Singapore healthy. For your own safety, and for those around you, please stand at least 1 meter apart. Thank you.
You know, I'm not like you'll pry my gun from my cold dead hands type of guy, but it does stick in the craw a bit, the idea that we're going to get pushed around by these robot dogs. I mean, how hard would it be to introduce elements of coercion here? I mean, at the moment, the robot dog is asking nicely, but how long until it gets like a switchblade or a flamethrower?
Yeah, according to Glenn Greenwald, one of the creepiest and most dystopian things I've seen since the pandemic began. A terrifying camera-equipped remote-controlled robot patrols Bishan Ang Mo Kio Park in Singapore to, for now, warn about social distancing. I mean, you can see in his mind that, you know, in 2 or 3 months, this thing is just going to have like RPGs stuck to the top and it's just going to start casually blowing people up.
I mean, once we invite these robot dogs in and then we ask them to leave, it's going to be like, you know, that unwanted guest who's like, I'm here
now. You give them an inch, they take a mile. Yeah. I'd like to think that we would have a referendum on robot dogs that were authorized to use deadly force.
Well, you hope so, but it's the thin end of the wedge. It's what Paul Merson called, you're on the glass staircase in moccasins.
This is Boston Dynamics, isn't it? This is the same company that did those robots that you could kick in the face and they'd get up again or whatever.
This might be their revenge. I mean, this always looked like something with the potential to destroy us all. So perhaps in trying to manage one existential threat, the plague, we're introducing another one of deadly coercive robots. I mean, are you going to let a robot dog push you around, tell you what to do?
I mean, I don't know whether I'd have an option. Well, that's it. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to call us pricks, you can do that on Twitter at BugRadio2020. And if 250 characters isn't sufficient for you to express your contempt, you can email us on BugRadio2020@gmail.com. We'll be back next week. Now wash your hands and piss off.